We're here with Mary Sinholz at her home in Grove City. It's July 10th, 2013. And Mrs. Sinholz, of course, has lived a long and fruitful life, and we're here to interview her about her life.
Oh, well, it's been long.
And your husband once told me that he married very well, and he had a premonition that you would outlive him.
Oh, really?
That's what he told me.
Well, he didn't tell me that. But, he always thought that because American women live longer than a man, he said, well, we should come out even. I was 8 years older than he. And he thought we should come out even. But here it is, 6 years long, 6 years beyond his death.
Well, let's start out with this question. How did you become involved with the Austrian economists?
Well, I didn't know anything about Austrian economics until I went to the Foundation for Economic Education. And as I mentioned before, Leonard Reed interviewed me and then said, when would you like to start? And I said, Monday. So it was then my education began as far as economics was concerned.
And what were you doing in your career before you went to FEE?
I just worked. Worked at one job or another. Mm-hmm. I worked when the war began. I said, well, I'm going to have to, my younger brother was going to be in the war effort. He was in the Air Force. And so I thought maybe I would be a WAC or something like that. And my older brother said, oh, no, you don't. You're not going to join that. So I, at the time, was working for a man who was the national president of general contractors. Mm. And he said, we have an office in Washington, D.C. Why don't I take you there? And he did. And the lady who was in charge said, I think I'll find you a job. But she said, I think you ought to work in the executive office of the president. And I said, that sounds good to me. And the next thing I knew, she had the interview all lined up. And so I started working for the executive office of the president. And I worked there for 6 years. Hmm. I was selected to be one of the staff members of the group that went to London and set up the United Nations.
Wow. So did you meet the president?
No, I didn't. But I didn't have to. And anyway, I went to London and I called back every Friday evening with a report back to Washington. And I was in London for 3 months.
So when you went to FEE, what was it like working at FEE?
Well, it was delightful, really. Leonard Reed had this feeling that he wanted to have an organization that would promote free enterprise. And that's what his aim and purpose was. And one of the people that he had on board was Mises. But he had a board of trustees, and the head of the board of trustees was J. Howard Pugh. Mm-hmm. You couldn't find anybody that was more in favor of free enterprise than J. Howard Pugh. We had a very kind of a family sort of relationship among the people that worked there. But as I said before, we had a formality that is missing in a lot of offices nowadays. Mr. Reed never called me Mary. He always called me Miss Homan. And the girls that came to work there never wore slacks. They wore skirts and suits. The men, too, were properly dressed. Some of them were ex-professors. Baldy Harper, Charlie Curtis. We had the facility, the housing, was a beautiful mansion built by a physician. And when he died, and the estate had charge of the building, they kept a woman by the name of Mrs. Campbell as a kind of caretaker. And so she came with the building so that when Leonard Reed decided to have his office there, he kept Mrs. Campbell, and she made our lunch every day. And it was a delightful setup.
Now, did you participate in some of the workshops or the seminars that they had there?
Oh, yes. I was oftentimes in charge.
Okay, great.
So did they assemble a large group of faculty? Would they have Mises and, say, your husband, Dr. Senholtz, and others all at the same time?
He was not there. At the beginning. And it was as I mentioned, Charlie Curtis and Baldy Harper. Each person had an office, and we had meetings every day. Every day we had meetings of the whole staff.
Was Hazlitt there at the beginning?
Well, he was never at the foundation.
Okay.
He was on the list of trustees.
Okay.
And he came frequently. But no, Henry Hazlitt was never at the foundation itself.
So do you remember your first encounter with Ludwig von Mises?
As I say, he was a consultant, and he would come up to the foundation in his little Chevy, a little black Chevy, and then he would come in and come up the stairs and had to go through my office to get to Leonard Reed's. And so we always greeted each other, and he wanted to know what language I had besides English, and I told him proudly I had French. Well, I had high school French, I had some college French, I had private lessons in French because Dean Russell was going to translate the law into English from the French, and I helped him. So I was proud of my French until I met Hans, and then I found out he'd taught French.
Yeah, he was hard to keep up with. So did you saw Mises lecture at Fee? Did you ever attend his New York University seminar?
Yes. He invited me to come, and then Bettina joined the staff. Bettina Bean was at that time, and the two of us would go to his classes. He had a regular class, which I attended, even got a B, I think, in the course. But then he had the seminars, too. And we went to the seminars, Bettina and I, and we didn't miss many seminars. As a matter of fact, Bettina, I think, kept notes, and She has been working on some of those notes, trying to transcribe them. I never was that ambitious about it all, but I enjoyed. And we had a large seminar. I would say 30 people around a table. And so we had this big table, but Mises sat at one end. But then there were other chairs, and I sat in one of the other chairs. One day, a young man sat in a chair right close to me and said, "Have you selected your topic for your dissertation?" And I wasn't in a dissertation mood. I said, "No, I haven't, but have you?" And he said, "Yes, I had a meeting with Dr. Mises today." And so that was the beginning of our conversation. And our and then he liked to tell how I always sat there with my legs crossed. One leg would be going up and down, and then I'd turn them this way and go down. And he says he couldn't see the professor on account of his legs going up and down. But that was just to make fun.
So was the debate in the seminar very vigorous, or?
It wasn't a debate. No. He spoke.
I see.
And then there were questions. Mm. But no, he would address the class, and then, as I say, he opened it up for questions.
Did you ever see Mises lecture at the Mont Pelerin Society
meeting? Oh, sure.
Yeah, and how was that?
Well, there were a number of people from other countries at the Mont Pelerin Society. And some of them I felt knew what they were talking about, and others I felt they didn't know. But it was open for discussion. Mm-hmm. When Dr. Mises spoke, I think everybody really paid attention. He was well liked and well respected. You had to listen carefully because his accent was rather heavy, but it being a group of people from a number of different countries, they were used to listening to accents.
So you must tell us about the personal relationship between the Senholtzes and the Miseses.
Mrs. Mises was a very good. I hate to use the word cook, but she knew how to present a meal, and she liked to do it. She would have occasionally would have the members, and there were around 30 or so. She would have them at their apartment for a meal, and oftentimes she would come to the seminar, but not always. Mm-hmm. Like Bettina and I were regulars, mm-hmm. but she didn't come as so often. She was always very careful about Dr. Mises. He had to eat just certain things, she felt, and do just certain things. And so she was very careful about him. I thought sometimes she especially paid attention to the ladies. And she thought that no one dare get that close to Dr. Mises. But
so tell us about the story of how she came to be the godmother of your son.
It was at one of the meetings that she had had in their apartment in New York. She had had a nice meal. And Bettina and I were the only ladies. Finally, Dr. Mises said, "Would you like to see my library?" And Bettina and I said, "Yes, we would." And so he took us to the room in which he had his library. And it was the shelves were chock full of books in at least four or five languages. Hmm. I didn't say it, but I felt like saying, "Do you read all these?" But it was really very, very crowded with books of all languages. And when we came back from having been out to look at his library, everybody seemed to have moved around in the room. Bettina and I were the only women, and all these men had just kind of moved around, shifted around, and sat somewhere else. And I looked around, and there was a settee, a man sitting there and a man sitting there, and I sat down in the middle and said, "May I sit here?" And Mrs. Mises nodded her head. That was the thing. That was the place for me to be, I guess. She felt that she had really helped to get us together. But probably one of the biggest things that happened was that Hans was had this interview with Mises. He had written his dissertation, pretty much so. He had 200 pages, and he had learned to type. So he had these pages typed, and he needed help with the English language. I think he said he had four or five different people who had said that they were editors. And he knew enough about English to know whether they were changing the thought that he wanted to get across. And so he fired one after another. He got rid of five editors and finally said to Dr. Mises, "I need an editor. Do you have a suggestion?" And Dr. Mises said, "Well, have you tried Miss Holman?" And he said, "No." Well, he said, "She has done some work for me, and I found it very satisfactory." So the next thing I knew, he was calling me on the phone and saying that he would like to bring me 100 pages to look at his dissertation. And I said, "Well, why don't you come to my apartment for a meal?" And I always thought it was a Sunday. But I found when he wrote his autobiography that he says it was a Saturday. And so I guess it was a Saturday. He was a little bit more precise. And then if I heard it once, I heard him say four or five times that he came to my apartment with his 100 pages in his hand and handed them to me. I took them and laid them down, went and got a bottle of wine and a bottle opener, handed it to him, and went to the piano and played Beethoven. He said, "I never left." At least that's the way he liked to tell it, because it made a good story. I think it was probably a week or so before I had the nerve to look at this thing. And then I did, and I saw what had happened. I saw that most of the people that he had decided that they were going to change the sentences in such a way that it made good sense to them. But it wasn't what he wanted. It wasn't what he was trying to say. And so I did it the way I thought he wanted it. And I finally had the nerve to say, "Do you want to look at it?" And he came up to my apartment and looked at it. And I had crossed out things. I had circled them. I had put them here and down there. And he looked at me and said, "Is it so bad?" And I felt so bad that I hadn't done it in the clear. I should have done that whole thing in the clear. I didn't. So next time he came, I had it all done in the clear for him. But he decided that he would keep me as an editor. And then, the more we worked together, we felt... We found we were thinking alike about things. And I don't know. Just one time he said, "Thought we ought to get married." And so he went and asked my father for my hand. Now, this isn't something you find going on nowadays. But he did. When he got a job at Iona College, I said, "Now we can get married." And that's what happened. We set our time for the 25th of July. And he got a job, as I say, at Iona College. And he had just taught there 1 year, but he was voted the most popular professor on campus. People liked him and students liked him because he didn't read from a book. He knew what he wanted to say. He knew what the material was that he wanted to cover on that day or in that class. And then he covered it. And he never stood around reading books or reading the script that he had. He never did that. You always felt as though he knew what he was talking about and you wanted to know more about it. Mm-hmm. So that was his method of teaching, and I think most of the students that had him felt that he was the best teacher they ever had. I'm sure that was true. He was the best teacher they'd ever had.
So your husband tells of the trips that you two took together when he was flying to various places in the country to deliver lectures. So
you know, he was a very good pilot. He never had an accident and never got into trouble. He was a very good pilot. He knew what he had to do and he knew how to get it done. We had some rather scary things happen, but we always got through them. I remember one time we were going through the Rocky Mountains and he had looked at all the maps before we took off through one of the passes. And we hadn't gone far in this pass when we met a thunderstorm. Mm. That's a no-no. So Bob was sitting beside his dad. He was 8 years old, I remember. And he was sitting beside his dad and saying, "Daddy, he was turning around." Mm. Turning the plane, And he said, "Daddy, you're going to hit the trees." But he didn't hit the trees. We turned around and went back and landed on an emergency strip that he had seen. Only a good pilot would see that. But he had seen this emergency strip, and he landed there. It really rained. We had a thunderstorm. It really rained. But Hans said, "Come on, Bob, we're going to find something to eat." And off they went, and presently Bob came back and said, "We found a restaurant." So, of course, I must mention that the whole time I was saying the Lord's Prayer, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want."
That's right. Yeah.
I was doing all those things. And anyway, Bob came back and said, "We're going to have lunch." And I tell you, at the time, I thought it was the best lunch I'd ever had. It was ham and a potato salad and all kinds of good things. After we had had our lunch and the rainstorm was past, we went back to the plane. And while we were still at the restaurant, an older man said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I should have had that grass cut, but I just didn't, and it's pretty long." And so, of course, with the rain on it, it was really dragging. We started, and he realized that he wasn't getting the speed he needed, and so he cut the motor, and we went back and revved it up again and tried again and didn't get the speed we needed, and so he cut the motor and went back. And then he said to me, "If we don't take off this next time, you're going to have to get out of the plane, take one of the big suitcases, find a ride, and go to the airport in, I think it was Seattle. Go to the airport and find a ride, and we'll pick you up there." Well, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. I sat back, and there was the try, the revving up of the motor to see whether we could take it off this time. And I was so happy when I felt it lift off. And I wasn't going to have to take the suitcase and find a ride to the airport. But this was just one of the instances in which he handled things properly. They were right. He did them right.
I also understand that that you traveled with the Mises's in Guatemala and to Mexico.
Yes, we. They wanted Dr. Mises there, but they also wanted somebody else that would be a backup, sort of. And I don't know whether they selected or whether Dr. Mises selected Hans, but at any rate, we went to Guatemala, and Mises, when he spoke, spoke as though, well, this is economics and this is the way it is. And I mean, it wasn't as though there was a question. This is the way it is. And he didn't get very excited about it, really. He just announced it. That's the way it was. And so if an audience wanted fireworks or anything, they had to have somebody besides Mises. And Hans could provide some of that. He was very good at it. And Yes, we had an interesting meeting at Guatemala, but that was like, well, most of the meetings that we did with the Mises were very interesting. Mm-hmm. I think Hans provided the liveliness that mm-hmm. was needed. Mises would just pronounce it, and then it was over, whereas Hans could give them a few examples and so forth.
Well, Ludwig von Mises must have really appreciated the Feshrit volume.
Yes, I think he did. I think he did.
It was a great contribution.
And Mrs. Mises liked traveling with us, too. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about J. Howard Pugh. So you also did some writing. You have a book about, well, kind of a biography, right, of
well,
J. Howard Pugh?
It was J. Howard Pugh was a very interesting man and a very important person. But he found that his staff at Sun Oil was going to write a book, and they were gathering material for it. And when he discovered that they were doing this, he said, "No, I don't want anything published, not while I'm alive." So that was the end of that. Finally, I remember the Mises were, we and the Mises were together, and we were at the foundation, and Mr. Reed and I were in the chow line, and he said, "How would you like to write a book about J. Howard Pugh?" I said, "That would be fun." And so that I had the material that the people at the Sun Oil had gathered together, they were willing to let me have that, and it was that I started with, and then did a lot of my own research. But now that was the way that one turned out. I had done some work before that for Leonard Reed, and I suppose that's why he asked whether I would like to do it.
Were you able to interview J. Howard Pugh for the material?
No, he was already gone.
Already gone. Well, you had mentioned he was on the board at FEE, so I thought maybe you would...
He was on the board. One time, just after Hans and I came to Grove City, we went to the president's office before one of the meetings, and what was the name of the man who he was kind of in charge of money for Grove City? At any rate, he thought it would be fun to put us in the same room. J. Howard Pugh was in this room. Hans and I came in to attend a trustee meeting. And this fellow, whoever his name was, said, "Come here." And we came there, and he opened the door and pushed us in. And there was J. Howard Pugh. And I think he must have been just as surprised as we were that here we were in the same room. Well, okay. We found something to talk about. Hans had decided the first year we were at Grove City that we should make sure that Mises got an honorary doctorate from Grove City College. And he also decided that it would be nice if Mary and Hans would have a reception for the faculty with Dr. and Mrs. Mises present. And so even though we had this house, pretty big house, but we didn't have it all completely furnished. And I remember this room over here with the open fireplace had one chair in it. And J. Howard too had been walking around in the house a little bit, kind of looking things over. And he finally had Mrs. Pugh sit down in this one chair in that room. But that's all we had in that room. So that was the first time we had a reception, but we had a number of receptions through the years. It's a big house.
Yes, indeed. So Mr. Pugh was a big supporter of your husband's.
I think it was Hans was speaking his language. And I think when Hans made some noises that perhaps he might leave Grove City College, Mr. Pugh would find a special project. And he really wanted Hans to stay.
Well, I wonder if that in part is because of the way Dr. Senholz always kept economics and morality together.
Yes, of course. And of course, that was a big thing for Mr. Pugh, too. But you can't be a good economist if you want to cheat and do things under the carpet and all that. So you can't be a good economist that way. You have to be straight. You have to keep your promises. You have to do what you said you would do and not cheat. Hans lived a straight life, and that's the way he tried to teach it. People oftentimes make promises, but they wanted a little bit of cheating here and a little bit of something else there. It won't matter. Nobody's going to know the difference. That isn't the way Hans felt about it, and that isn't the way Mr. Pugh felt about it. They felt that if you made a promise, you had to stay and live by it.
In addition to Mises, what other economists did your husband admire?
Well, of course, he did some translating, and the books that he translated and were all in the realm of Austrian economics. And he did some translation of Bombardier, and of course Menger was one of the. And I would say that he was supportive or was eager to have everybody understand the works of those men.
So you started out with the Austrian School at Phi, and then after Dr. Senholz retired from Grove City, he went back to Phi and became president. So what was it like on your second time around?
Well, it was different. It was different. But the organization had really gotten into trouble financially and otherwise. And so Hans, I think, was just interested to see whether he could pull it off, whether he could really do it, whether a lot of these things he was saying to people about how to run an organization, whether it was really true, whether it was practical. And he wanted to test himself, I think. But he did it by looking at the expenses and how how the money was being spent, and you could see it was off track. So he put it back on track. He got he was able to, it was in the red, but he was able to get it back in the black very quickly. Took a lot of people off of an insurance thing that they weren't working there anymore, but they were having all this insurance, and it was expensive. And not only that, but he found a way to found a place where they would insure, and it would be just as good, but a whole lot less expensive. Mm-hmm. So as I say, he wanted to test himself, and he found out he could do it. Mm-hmm. He had the foundation back in the black. And I thought we were very fortunate in that while we were there, we had the 50th anniversary of the foundation. Mm-hmm. And Hans did a magnificent job there. I didn't know he had it in him, but he did. He really did a good job.
Well, I'll never forget the, in 2004, when the Mises Institute gave Hans Senholtz the Gary Schlarbaum Prize.
Yes, I was there.
It was
I think
wonderful
I played
event.
Happy Birthday for
yes,
somebody.
Yeah, it was great.
I played Happy Birthday more times than you can count. Well, anyway, it was a nice occasion.
Yeah, it's kind of the Austrian Nobel Prize in economics, or lifetime achievement, which your husband certainly accomplished.
Well, I think he was well deserving of it.
Indeed.
Because you wouldn't have me say anything else.
Right. I would be interested if you recall Sir Mises's impressions on economists of his day. Say, did he have any interaction, say, with some of the Chicago School economists like Frank Knight or later on Milton Friedman or anything like that?
Oh, Milton Friedman. You know, one of the most disgraceful things I ever saw take place was at the Mount Pelerin meeting. And Milton Friedman stood there a little bit off stage while I don't remember who it was speaking. But Milton Friedman was a little bit off stage, but making signs and doing all kinds of things to take the audience's attention away from the speaker. It was, I still say, it was one of the most disgraceful things I've ever witnessed. I don't know why he did it. I don't think he had to do that to get his attention. I don't understand why he did it that way, but I witnessed it, and a lot of other people witnessed it.
Well, this has been great. I think that's, unless you have other things you'd like to tell us.
I don't think so.
We certainly appreciate the interview.
I don't think so. Hope I was helpful in some way.
Absolutely.
Yes, thank you.
It's been wonderful.